Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 28, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss property rights in the Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I am very pleased to welcome return Teleforum guest James S. Burling. He's Vice President of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation, intimately involved in this case. He's going to give us some background on the case in his opening remarks of 15 to 20 minutes or so. But as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind. With that, Jim, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. So this case is all about how to determine what property one is talking about when a landowner claims property has been taken by regulation. You can look at it in these terms. If all you own is 1 acre of property, and that property is designated entirely to be wetland, open space, endangered species habitat, and you can't use that property at all, that 1 acre at all, then there's no question that your property has been taken. But what if you own 10 acres of property around that? The other 9 acres are developable. You still can't use this 1 acre. Have you had anything taken? Is the law, the more you own, the more government can take? And that's the issue that was before the court in Murr versus Wisconsin, a decision that I think is so unworkable that's going to fail the test of time. So let's go into a little bit of the history of the case first. The Murr family, parents, they were middle-class people. They owned a plumbing company in Wisconsin. They bought this beautiful lot at 1.25 acres fronting Lake St. Clair in 1960. They built a small 950-square-foot cabin on that property, and they liked it so much they decided as an investment to buy the lot next door. Not with a plan to do anything with it at any time, but just to have it there as the family, sort of the treasure, the money in the bank, if you will, because they knew how wonderful this area was. So they owned these two lots, and one was owned separately by the husband and wife. One was owned by their plumbing company, and things moved along. In 1975, there were land use regulations put in place. These land use regulations impose setbacks for water frontage, for steep slopes, etc. And as a result of these setbacks, the buildable area on these 1.25 acre lots was now less than a half of an acre. And as such, they were non-conforming lots. Nobody thought too much of that. In 1994 and 1995, the parents had become quite elderly and transferred the two lots respectively to the children. So you have one lot fronting the lake with a cabin on it, one lot that is not used at all, has nothing on it, called the investment lot by the family. And in 1995, the children own these lots in their own name. As a unified family, they own the property. In 2004, they began exploring the possibility of selling the second lot. They frankly needed the money to fix up the cabin on the first lot. It was now getting quite old, and it had some problems with some water rising and a little bit of flooding from time to time, and they thought it's really time to put some real money into fixing this thing up. And they were told at that time that, no, they can't sell the second lot. Why? Because it is substandard. And the substandard lot can't be sold. Now, there was a grandfather clause that if anybody else had owned this second lot, that anybody else could have developed it or sold it. But because the Murrs owned this lot and they owned the lot next door, the agency said, no, you cannot sell or develop your second lot because you own the one next door. They went for a variance at the Zoning Board of Appeals. It was denied. They brought a taking case in Wisconsin state courts, arguing that, look, we have this lot that has no use and value left to it. It is a taking. But the court disagreed. The court said that there is a well-established rule that contiguous property under common ownership is considered as a whole, regardless of the number of parcels contained therein. In other words, the more you own, the more government can steal. And this was a rather extraordinary rule saying in all cases that if you have contiguous lots for terms of zoning, they have to be considered as one. So if the MERS own one lot or 10 lots, they'd all be considered together as one. The MERS at that point came to us and Pacific Legal Foundation. After they were denied by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, they came to us and we asked the Supreme Court to take the case. The court took the case. It took quite a long time for the court to get around to holding oral argument after the death of Justice Scalia. And we think it was because it was a very close opinion and the Justice Roberts was waiting for another member of the court. As it turned out, it just took so long that we had oral argument before Justice Gorsuch came on, and Justice Gorsuch was not part of this case. But the court really confused, I think, the issues of contiguous parcels substantially in its decision. Now, I should mention that today, June 28th, is the 25th anniversary of Lucas, the Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Council case. And that looms large in this case because there the court said that the first thing you have to look when you're deciding whether or not you have a taking claim is what is the nature of the property interest? What are the background principles of the property? And so Lucas teaches the wise practitioner that in order to win any taking case, whether you're going to bring a total wipeout under the Lucas rule or a Penn Central balancing test or whatever, you first have to understand what the property is in order to understand what has been taken. And there is a footnote in Lucas saying, well, you know, if you have more than one lot, it might not be an all or nothing. You have to look at what the relevant parcel is. Penn Central says you look at the relevant parcel. Penn Central is a case, of course, involving the New York City Railroad Terminal that they wanted to build a skyscraper on top, and the court would not look at the air rights separately from the rest of the real estate. And so the question has come up, for a situation like the MERS, what has been taken? Do you look at the one lot, the investment lot, where there's no use in value, or do you combine that with the adjacent lot, or as Wisconsin court said, the adjacent lots if they own more than that? And then you look at the impact, the economic impact of the regulation. If all you look at is the one investment lot, then clearly there's been a total wipeout. There's been a taking, and it's obvious, like my example earlier of the person who owns 1 acre of wetland and nothing else. But now that the MERS are told to consider both lots together in a takings analysis, they have some use of the cabin. They can build, they have, a 950-square-foot cabin on one of the lots. They could tear that cabin down and build a bigger house, a house perhaps that straddles both the investment lot and the original cabin lot. So there the court said that there is no taking. But the question is, what about this individual lot? This individual lot was separately deeded, separately taxed for years and years, and it was really considered to be separate under Wisconsin law. There is never any formal merger. And so the court began well enough in this opinion of the Supreme Court in Murr, an opinion by Kennedy, talking nice talk about property rights. Kennedy says, for example, property rights are necessary to preserve freedom, for property ownership empowers persons to shape and plan their own destiny in a world where governments are always eager to do so for them. That's typical Kennedy-esque nice language. Everyone, I think that just sounds wonderful. But then the very next sentence says, the other persisting interest is the government's well-established power to adjust rights for the public good. Is my response to that. So the question, Kennedy begins saying whether there are reasonable expectations about property ownership would lead a landowner to anticipate that his holdings would be treated as one parcel or instead of separate tracts. The inquiry, he says, is objective, and the reasonable expectations at issue derive from background customs and the whole of our legal tradition. More of this Kennedy, rather vague but high-sounding language. But if you unpack that sentence, which talks about reasonable expectations as this, it's an objective standard, but it's really subjective. Is my expectation objective or subjective? And if you're talking about reasonable expectations as defining what the property is in and of itself in the first instance, well, I expect I own 2, 3, 4, 5 parcels, but do I expect them to be treated as one or treated as separate tracts? It becomes very difficult. So Kennedy put it into a 3-part test. And the first part began innocently enough. He says substantial weight is given to the treatment of the land, in particular, how it is bounded or divided under state or local law. That's exactly what we were arguing. Our argument was that the lot lines and the deeds that are recorded in the county courthouse should create a presumption of separate parcels because that's the way they are considered under the law. But then Kennedy moves on. He says, we have to have a reasonable expectation of an acquirer of land must acknowledge that the legitimate restriction affecting his or her subsequent use or dispensation of the property. In other words, you buy property knowing the government can come in later and tell you that you can't use it, and therefore you have no expectation to be able to use it. This is very circular reasoning. And then he continues, a reasonable restriction that predates a landowner's acquisition can be one of the objective factors that landowners would reasonably consider in forming fair expectations about the property. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, a reasonable restriction that predates a landowner's acquisition. So what's reasonable, what's not, can be an objective factor that most landowners would reasonably consider. I would think if I bought a separate lot for investment purposes, that if it was a buildable lot, I could develop that, and I wouldn't necessarily anticipate the government coming in later and telling me not to. Am I being reasonable or unreasonable? Anyway, let's move to the second factor that Kennedy raises. And the second factor is the physical characteristics of the landowner's property. He talks about the physical relationship of any distinguishable tract, the parcel's topography, and the surrounding human and ecological environment is relevant to determining whether or not this is a separate parcel. Pray tell, what is the surrounding human and ecological environment supposed to mean other than full employment for land use attorneys for a century to come? Everybody's going to be arguing, well, the physical relationship of distinguishable tracts concerns the human environment or the ecological environment. Now, I frankly don't know what that means. And then he continues that in particular, it may be relevant that the property is located in an area that's subject to or likely to become subject to environmental or other regulation. And here, Kennedy is citing his concurring opinion in Lucas. Lucas is a case where Justice Scalia and the majority of the court found South Carolina had taken David Lucas's property because they destroyed all use and value of that property. But Kennedy had a concurrence that would have added a number of wishy-washy factors to the Lucas opinion. It was only a concurrence and it didn't carry the day, but you can see Kennedy reaching back from his concurrence 25 years ago and sticking that into the Murr decision. So he talks about what's likely to become or subject to other regulation. Does that mean that if you buy nice property in a nice area, you should anticipate increasing government regulation? He continues with, I think, a very chilling quote for anybody who owns property in coastal areas. He says, quote, coastal property may present such unique concerns for a fragile land system that the state can go further in regulating its development and use than the common law of nuisance might otherwise permit. Lucas, of course, was coastal property. Lucas was quite clear that government could not impose regulations beyond those that are part of the background principles of nuisance law. But here, Kennedy is saying coastal property is unique. Government can regulate it without takings liability, but I think that's what he's saying, if it is a coastal area that nuisance law wouldn't allow this restriction, but if it's a good idea because coastal property will do that. The third factor Kennedy talks about, he says courts should assess the value of the property under the challenge regulation, with special attention to the effect of burdened land on the value of other holdings. In other words, in this particular case, the investment lot did make the cabin lot more valuable because the investment lot gave open space to the cabin lot and therefore added some value to it, and that sort of thing should be considered. So, in other words, Kennedy is talking about this sort of this gestalt of everything that is thrown into this basket together, and we'll just talk about it and argue it until the lawyers can go home late in the evening sometime, I suppose. The court did recognize that the state of Wisconsin was completely ignoring that lot lines, and they should have some value to here, but I think that by and large, the standards that Kennedy has put into considering what the property is in the first place, investment-backed expectations, that sort of thing traditionally was considered after we defined what the lot was. So first step, as I said at the outset, is you define what the property is. The second step is to consider whether that property has been taken. And in that second step, under Penn Central, we had considered such things as investment-backed expectations, the value of the regulation, the character of the regulation, so on and so forth. But now Kennedy is saying that in the first step of defining what the property is, you get to consider all these other factors, and then you're going to consider them again in the second step. So, this is a multi-factor standard on steroids. Kennedy talks about the treatment of property under state and local law, indicates petitioner's property should be treated as one only because of voluntary conduct in bringing the lots under common ownership. That is because the parents gave both lots to the children voluntarily, and the children didn't realize that there was this sort of Damocles hanging over them by accepting both lots. At oral argument, Justice Ginsburg at one point said, well, you know, they should have known. They should have said, Mom and Dad, we don't want that second lot. Give it to somebody else. Seriously. The parents were old. They didn't realize that giving both lots to the children would create this problem, so they should have seen it coming. Kennedy says petitioners could have anticipated public regulation might affect their enjoyment of their property. So it's not only what regulations are in place today, but you should have seen it coming. Now, Justice Roberts had a dissent, and it was a good dissent in some ways, but a very troubling dissent in other ways. So let me give a quote and get what I'm talking about. This bottom line conclusion does not trouble me. The majority presents a fair case that the MERS can still make good use of both lots, and that the ordinance is a commonplace tool to preserve scenic areas for the benefit of landowners and the public alike. And then Roberts gets into saying that, you know, this is really putting the cart before the horse. The result is that the government's regulatory interests will come into play not once, but twice. First, when identifying the relevant parcel, and again when determining the regulation has placed too great a public burden on that property. So, in other words, Roberts isn't terribly upset about the result here. He thinks, the MERS have lost the ability to use this property alone and separately, but they still get something out of it because their other lot is worth more now, and they can combine them and build a big house on them, I suppose. And there is one other dissent by Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas said, you know, our regulatory takings doctrine is not very well founded in the law. There's been a lot of debate of whether it's in the takings clause. Maybe it should be a due process, maybe privileges and immunities. He cites a law review article to that extent. I'm not quite sure. I think there's plenty of good scholarship that the court apparently is not aware of that talks about property rights and first principles, and that the regulatory takings doctrine really is not something that came up in whole cloth with Justice Holmes, and that it was really part and parcel of the way that this nation has viewed property for a long time, for centuries now, since the founding. But that scholarship is a little lost, so we have Thomas asking for us to look again at first principles. It might not hurt in future briefing to this and other courts to remind the court that there are strong doctrinal bases before the regulatory takings doctrine, but this was not the case to do it in. So that is the Murr decision in a nutshell. Before I go to questions, I just want to give one quick footnote, because yesterday, I think it was yesterday, yeah, the court also denied cert in a case called Lost Tree versus Corps of Engineers. This is a case out of the Federal Circuit. It involves some Florida property where a developer had developed lots of property, and there's a little appendage that the developer didn't do anything with for many years. It wasn't part of the development plan. Eventually wanted to develop that last parcel, and the Corps of Engineers said no, and the Corps of Engineers said there's no taking because you own all the surrounding property and you developed that already. But the Court of Federal Claims, as upheld by the Federal Circuit, said no, this last little appendage was the lot to look at because all uses denied on that lot, it was taken. And the Supreme Court denied cert on the government's request to take that case up. And I take that as a sign that here is a case where a court looked at a whole variety of factors, and it determined after looking at those factors that there was a single parcel that had the use had been denied on and that it had been taken. So if people want to see perhaps what the post-Murr world should look like as far as the factors that get litigated in a regulatory taking case, perhaps the denial of cert in Lost Tree indicates that the court was satisfied that the analysis had been properly done. So you should look at the Lost Tree case out of the Federal Circuit and before that, the Court of Federal Claims. With that, I think that about is my thumbnail sketch of the Murr decision, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you very much. We're speaking with Jim Burling. If you've joined us late, we are going to open the floor to questions now. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Jim Burling, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me give the typical commercial announcement. Our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at noon. We'll be talking about another Supreme Court case, the Mesa case. This is the cross-border shooting case. Very interesting. That's tomorrow at noon. We'll have a second telephone tomorrow as well at 2 p.m. Discussing the use of science in lawmaking. So the next one's tomorrow at noon. Today, of course, we're talking about the Murr property rights case decided earlier this week by the Supreme Court. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one caller, and then our lines are wide open. Let's take our first call.
Oh, Jim, this is Jim Ely. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Jim. I hope you're doing well also.
Very well. I really appreciated your careful analysis of the Murr decision. One comment, now I guess one question. Comment is that I think you're quite right about Justice Kennedy's opinion. It's murky. It's probably ultimately unworkable. It's very disappointing in almost every way. I think Penn Central itself is dubious enough with all of its almost incoherent factors, but to project it into the definition of property, I think is just really a very unfortunate step in the wrong direction. My second comment, though, really relates to Justice Thomas's sole dissent. And you've raised a point that I think really warrants more attention from scholars, and I include myself. He suggests that it was generally recognized that there would be no regulatory takings, only direct appropriation of property worth taking before Pennsylvania coal. That is simply inaccurate. I do not know why the court, and I think Justice Scalia has repeated that as well. There's all kinds of scholarship indicating that people, scholars and judges, were thinking in terms of severe regulation as a taking long before Pennsylvania coal. As a matter of fact, Holmes himself, when he was on the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, toyed with that very idea. I find that very distressing that this just gets repeated over and over, and I don't know how to break out of it, but I do think it would be very useful if at some point counsel would endeavor to correct that misapprehension by the Supreme Court.
Jim, I absolutely agree with you. And for the listeners who are not familiar with Jim Ealy's work, I think a good place to start on the jurisprudence of property rights is The Guardian of Every Other Right, an excellent and very readable book that Jim Ealy wrote a number of years ago. And I completely agree with you. There is lots of good scholarship taking to task the notion that only direct condemnations of property were subject were part and parcel of the takings clause. There's been good authorship, good articles written by not only Jim Ealy, Chris Kobach wrote an article, Andrew Gold wrote an article. There's an article by Professor Thomas as well. There's lots of good articles out there talking about this issue. And if anybody emails to me, I can send you a bibliography of at least half a dozen good articles and books on that subject. So I think it's a grave mistake for the court to think that the takings clause only refers to the direct appropriation of property. There are plenty of cases in the early 19th century, for example, where property was taken by other means and compensation was awarded. That was talked about quite a bit in Chris Kobach's article in the 1996 Utah Law Review article.
Yeah, I think that your point's very well taken, and I just think this is an area that maybe counsel got to drive this point home in some way to the court. For example, Thomas cites the legal tender cases. They have nothing whatsoever to do with land use issues.
Yeah, I mean, it was perplexing. He should know better. I think he just has to read the right articles, and we'll have to maybe send him copies.
Well, anyway, with those two thoughts, I will sign off. But I enjoyed your presentation, Jim. And
thank
I hope
you,
maybe our paths will cross again before too long.
All right.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Jim Burling, this is Dean Reuter. Maybe two questions or comments. Rather than give out your email address, it might be helpful if we could just get you to do a one-paragraph blog post citing some of the articles or giving that bibliography you mentioned, and that way everybody could find them on the Federal Society's blog.
I'll be happy to do that.
My second comment, it goes to this discussion you're having with Jim Ealy. Was this issue briefed in this case, or is there another case in the short-term future on which there could be an amicus brief that goes directly to the court's lacuna, or however you would describe it in this area?
No, this was not an issue that was before the court. We were all pretty much assuming that the regulatory takings doctrine is strong and well-established, and the concern that it might not be grounded in the takings clause really had not come up. I am not aware of any cases where this issue is front and center. I would certainly suggest perhaps that it would be nice to have amicus cases, not only at the United States Supreme Court level, but also at the courts of appeals, state courts, just reminding the courts that are hearing these taking cases that the takings doctrine has a long pedigree for establishing regulatory takings issues. They didn't all come from Justice Holmes' minds in Pennsylvania coal in 1922. We had a long tradition before that. So yeah, I'll put up something on the blog on Pacific Legal Foundation's blog site as well, pointing out that there is a good deal of scholarship on the origins of the regulatory takings doctrine.
Great. And we've got three audience questions pending. I'll get to those in a moment. I wanted to ask one quick question, if I could, Jim, and that's the second leg of Kennedy's test. It is a bit opaque to me as well, but I'm wondering if there had been a fence between these two properties that had never been taken down, would that be helpful to Kennedy in finding a regulatory takings? Or perhaps if there had been a boat ramp easement that had run down between these properties, whether it was used or not, sort of a dividing line that was there for other purposes. Is that the sort of thing Kennedy's talking about that would make these more reasonably seen as two parcels?
It's hard to say, of course, because he doesn't go into any of the detail, the sort of things I think. I mean, certainly, if there had been a fence between these two parcels, and I would suggest anybody that owns two contiguous parcels now put up a fence between them, hey, put up a wall between them and make the other property owner pay for it. No, I'm kidding about that. But you know, anything that can show any kind of geographic difference, different
maybe a stream. I mean, a stream running through down the border. If that's the
stream running, I mean, I would argue anything. Like, if you're a lawyer, you're going to argue anything you can on the separateness of the lots as a physical factor. So topography, if one had a building site, one area, and the other was completely separate from that, and you couldn't mm-hmm. join the two of them together like you could here, that may have been a factor. Road between the two lots, the more you can show separateness based on the ground, the better. I'm not quite sure what the what some of the talks about the human environment means. Ecological environment, yeah, it could be the stream, but I would certainly argue separateness for any physical way I could.
Right, maybe a non-navigable drainage ditch. But let's turn to our next audience member for another question.
Hey Jim, thanks a lot. This is Jack Park. In the aftermath of Kelo, a number of states passed laws restricting the wide-ranging use of eminent domain. Should states consider codifying the denominator principle that's favorable to property rights?
I think, Jack, that's an excellent question and a good idea, and it's something that we actually had a great deal of discussion in our offices just yesterday about. Wisconsin, some legislators are very unhappy about this result, and they're trying to have legislation passed that would make it more clear that separately deeded lots of this nature should be considered separately. We're going to see where that goes. We're going to do what we can. But, yeah, we are looking into perhaps getting some legislative options that some favorable legislators may pass. I mean, one problem with after Kelo is a case that outraged everybody because every homeowner realized after Kelo that their property was subject to the whim of the local government. I mean, I recall sitting in my dentist's office shortly after the Kelo decision, my dentist saying, "Does this mean they can take my house for a shopping center?" And I answered, "Yeah, all right, Han." Of course, I had, you know, things in my mouth and I couldn't talk very well, but I shook my head and said, "Yeah." And that got people's attention. This case, it's a little more difficult for people to understand the nature of the injustice here because most people don't own a lot next to the one where they have their home. But nevertheless, I think it is something that legislators ought to look at to make sure that when people buy a lot of property and they get a mortgage on one or more of those properties, they want to have at least two different lots. And there is a danger to mortgage companies that how do they lend money on the second lot if it could be combined with a lot next to it. This could be a danger to communities that want to see their property, their land develop. They want to have an active real estate market. Things like this could slow that down. So there may be reasons why a legislature would want to have a fix to this. So I think that's a great idea, Jack.
Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending. Let's take another call.
Hi, Jim. This is Wiley Boston in Florida. Thank you very much for that excellent summary of the case, which I have not read yet. My question is, would it be possible to read this case as being limited to situations where there is a deemed merger regulation as a matter of law in existence and then a change of title where somebody acquires title to both those lots after that regulation is a law, and only applying to those types of circumstances, or do we need to be worried about a much broader scope for this?
Well, I mean, any good land use attorney is going to try to confine this opinion to its facts, and any good government attorney is going to try to expand this opinion well beyond the facts of this particular case, and that's why good litigators are going to have to do a good job arguing their particular side. But I think your point is well taken, that if I were representing landowners, I would argue that this is a very unique factual circumstance. And I would try to minimize these broad and amorphous tests that Kennedy came up with and said, hey, this is a case just about these particular circumstances. Because we see all the time courts who don't like the particular result that a prior opinion would otherwise militate say, hey, that's confined to the facts. We don't have to worry about it. And there are plenty of examples where courts have pretty much ignored the prior holding of a case saying, hey, it's confined to its facts and we have slightly different facts. So I'd certainly argue that. But nevertheless, I am worried. I am worried that this broad language that Kennedy has can be used, or government attorneys are going to try to use it, and they will have sympathetic courts that will agree with them that this language is as broad as the sky is high.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are wide open again. Let's check in with another caller.
Hi, this is Chris Berger from Kansas. This is an area that's pretty new to me, actually. And I was, so from an elementary level and maybe mistaken as well, two questions. One is, why, I understand regulatory takings to be any time that there's a loss of all value with regard to a tract. And so the first question is, why didn't they just limit themselves to an analysis as to whether or not there was any residual value and avoid the issue entirely? Then the second question is, on a direct takings analysis, oftentimes the property owner will assert that there's a larger parcel involved and therefore the taking has a greater impact on their operation or their land. And is this just, you know, the application in the regulatory taking settings of the same larger parcel rule, only backwards?
Let me take your first question first, and why did they not consider whether there's residual value here? Well, if you looked only at the investment lot, there was a total wipeout of use and value of that lot. It really couldn't be used for anything of any significance. Oh, there may have been some little residual value, but they were arguing that that was most likely a total wipeout under the Lucas decision. But if it not that, then certainly a taking under Penn Central, where you look at the factors of the investment-backed expectations, the economic impact of the regulation, and the character of the regulation. But by combining the two lots together, that meant that there was use and value of the two lots now considered one. So much use and value that it's certainly not a taking under Lucas, and so much use and value that it's really not plausibly a taking under Penn Central, at least according to the government, and it seems to be from Kennedy's opinion. So that's why you have to identify the lot first before you look at it. And your second question is on the eminent domain or the direct takings analysis. Yes, landowners, and this was one of the examples that we used at oral argument, landowners will often say that if you take one parcel, that could have a negative impact on the next door parcel, and we're entitled to compensation for that negative impact. The typical case might be that if you have one parcel that has a parking lot on it and another parcel has a hotel on it, if the government takes the parking lot, that has not only an impact on the parking lot parcel, but it has an impact on the hotel parcel because you can't use the hotel the way you could before if people can't park there. And so there has been a harming of the value of the hotel parcel, and you're entitled to damages for that. And this case is in some ways the reverse of that, where we are arguing the where the government's arguing that the ability to use one lot adds value to the second lot, or they're combining them together. What we were suggesting to the court was that, look, in direct eminent domain cases, you can look at two separate lots, keep them in separateness, but still have compensation for either or both of the lots if there's a taking. And you don't have to combine them together before you have a damages to the second, or as my example, the hotel lot. But the court and the court talked about that a little bit, about the direct takings analogy, but not to the extent that I thought it was particularly helpful to us. And so I go back again saying that to the fact that this single lot now is unusable, that that was the argument why it was a taking. Now, there's some difficulty in the argument because they do have the other lot and they could build a single big house on both of them, but that's not what the MERS wanted to do. They didn't have the money to buy, to sell, to build a huge house straddling both of the lots. They just wanted to get enough money to fix up their 950-square-foot cabin. That they can't do, so is there an alternative to have to sell both lots and move somewhere else? That may be.
I thought during the argument there was some discussion that by having the two lots, the value of the two might not be the same value as each one sold separately, but was still more valuable than having just the one.
That's correct. Having the two lots together so you could put up a bigger house that would straddle both lots did add a certain value. So overall, the diminution in value wasn't that great if the two lots are considered together. But as I said, the problem for the MERS is that that's not going to do them much good because they need to get the money to fix the cabin. They don't have the money to build a big house straddling both lots would enable them to realize the value of the property. So that was a practical problem for the MERS. And as you recall from the argument, some members of the court, especially Alito, if I recall, understood that you know, what they want is not to be able to sell these two lots. They want to be able to keep the cabin lot and get money to fix up the cabin.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We have another question pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. My name is Don Padu. I'm a lawyer in practice in D.C. I have a couple of regulatory takings cases that have kind of been hanging fire waiting for this decision. And therefore, I'm kind of interested in the comment you made in your presentation that you thought Kennedy's decision probably would not stand the test of time because it's unworkable. If you could flesh it out some more, I'd appreciate it. In particular, I read the opinion and I read Robert's dissent, and there's so many factors there that kind of my prediction is that trial courts are going to start treating this as a balancing test. Plaintiff's property interest versus the reasonableness of the government's regulation. And Roberts he seemed to be thinking along the same lines. He had a comment about double counting in his dissent. But I'd be interested in your viewpoint about how this opinion is going to be applied at the trial court level.
Yeah, so before this opinion, we had a lot of balancing going on with the Penn Central test once the property was defined. Now we're going to have balancing tests in determining what the parcel is in the first place that you're looking at, where you have these contiguous parcel cases. And so when I say I think it's going to be unworkable, to a significant degree, Penn Central has proven to be unworkable. It's a morass. It involves a great deal of hand-wringing over what investment-backed expectations are, which I think is a purely subjective issue that's somewhat irrelevant. And now we're going to have the same sort of hand-wringing and great detailed arguments, people arguing over the human and ecological environment. And there's going to be a point where we're going to sit back and look at this mess and ask ourselves, was this necessary to be arguing over all these factors, eating up a tremendous amount of trial work time, or is there a better way of doing it? I think the court had, in some instances in the past few years, has looked at the Penn Central test and realized that it's a problem that landowners often lose. Nobody's come up with a better solution yet, but eventually, my hope is that the court will look both at Penn Central and now at this MER multi-factor define the parcel test and realize that, you know, there are better ways. I think we had posited the better way that the lot lines create a presumption of separateness, which can be overcome. There's the number of times when you can overcome a presumption of separateness. Say the lots were truly substandard and would create an actual nuisance to develop small postage stamp size lots that you sometimes have in recreational coastal areas where lots were, you know, a quarter or an eighth of an acre or something absurd like that, where you can't develop them if you have to have septic systems and that kind of thing. And that's the sort of time where I think the presumption could be overcome. But to have this multi-factor balancing test, I think is going to be proving very unworkable. It's going to be very difficult, very expensive for landowners to pursue. And it's one that I would hope that when different personnel that may inhabit the court in the future go back and look at this and realize that, nice try, but this is something we need to move away from. That's my hope.
Thank you.
Well, Jim, we have one more question. We've still got some time left, so let's carry on. Move on to
okay.
our next caller.
Thank you for your description of MER. I want to ask you a couple of questions about what I would describe as, let's say, strategic behavior, and I think they might cut in opposite directions. First of all, is it possible that Justice Kennedy was just trying to get out in front of strategic behavior, not by the MERS? Doesn't look like there was any strategic behavior on their part, but strategic behavior, for example, where somebody owns some property, some of which can't be developed because it's a wetland, let's say, and then conveys that property to a straw, and then the straw divides it into two lots, one of which is the wetland and the other of which is the developable property, and then conveys it back. And the point of MER is to frustrate that kind of strategic behavior. And then coming at it from the other direction, what stops people now going forward from being much more strategic about how they bequeath property to their children? For example, I don't know how many kids the MERS had. Let's say they had four. Give one of the pieces of property, I guess lot E, to two of the kids and lot F to the other two kids. Then you don't have common ownership, and that defeats Wisconsin's regulation. In other words, I'm just wondering if you could pay some attention or give some thought, think out loud, let's say, to strategic behavior either way in this kind of a case.
Yeah. So let's go back to the original example I began with the outset. You own 10 acres of property, 1 acre is a wetland. You know that if all you owned was that 1 acre, that you would be compensated for it because all use and value has been destroyed. But because you own the other nine, if the 10 acres are considered together, you've only had a 10% diminution in value of the property, not enough to have a taking under either Lucas or most likely Penn Central. So what is to stop the owner of that 10 acres from dividing the lots into two, one 1 acre and 1 9 acre lot, or why not 10 1 acre lots? And I guess I have two responses to that. First of all, the authorities to be, the zoning authorities that have to approve these subdivisions, can very well say, we're not going to allow this sort of strategic subdivision. We're not going to allow a lot to be created that is not usable, that's not valuable, that would be just walking straight into a taking case. So, I mean, any zoning board worth its salt will recognize that there is an unbuildable lot here, that one is where there's no use and value. It just might not allow that to be developed. So that's a way of dealing with that. But my second response is what's the problem with that? If government has taken all of that 1 acre of wetland and you can no longer use it, why should the owner, just because the owner owns other property nearby, have to bear the entire burden and cost of that? If government and the citizens think it's important enough to preserve that 1 acre of property, they should pay something for it. Maybe not a whole lot, but they should pay something for that rather than the burden being on the landowner. Because what this means is that the more somebody owns, the more the government can take. If all you own is that 1 acre, you get compensated. But if you own more acres, more lots next door, the government doesn't have to compensate you for it, but the regulation accomplishes the exact same thing. It has taken all use and value of the wetland parcel. So that's my response to the strategic behavior response of the front end. On the back end, once you own these lots, what's to prevent somebody from bequeathing them to two children in one case and two children in the other case? Absolutely nothing. I mean, I think the first strategic behavior people are going to engage in after a case like this, if they're savvy enough, is that they're never going to buy two contiguous lots in one name. quite clearly that is unwise to do. You buy one in the wife's name, one in the husband's name, one in the child's name, one in the dog's name, or whatever. And you make sure that you have your will set out in the way that these lots are never going to be combined again. And if you do own these lots in a single parcel, you are going to try to devise them to your children separately, assuming you can do that under the regulations. I mean, the particular regulations in this case do not restrict the gifting of property. You just can't sell it. So who knows what other people in the future are going to do in a situation like this. So I think certainly anybody who owns contiguous parcels ought to consider sooner rather than later how to get those separated out into different ownerships.
Thank you.
So, Jim, this is Dean Reuter again. Going forward now, is there something that prohibits the MERS from gifting to a straw man the investment lot, who could then bring a takings claim because 100% of their property has been taken or diminished in value, and then giving the lot back to the MERS along with the recovery from the takings case?
Well, you know, at the Supreme Court, that was one of the things that was pointed out, that this property could be gifted. Rather than that, I frankly don't know what the MERS are planning to do. They're assessing their circumstances right now. Maybe they just get tired of the whole thing and want to sell both lots and move on with their lives and just not have this beautiful family recreational cabin on the St. Croix River. Maybe they'll want to do other things. I really can't speak for what their plans are.
Right. Very good. We are out of questions here today. Let me. We still have a couple minutes left. Do you have a final thought you want to give us, Jim Burling?
My final thought is that we've always known that regulatory takings doctrine was a complicated corner of the law, a dark area of the law, if you will, because it needs a lot more light shone on it. This decision is only going to make it all that more complicated and difficult. And that is great news for attorneys who practice in that area, because that means that there is a whole new scope of work for us to do. But for landowners, I think this is a severe disappointment. I think this decision makes property rights a lot less secure than they used to be, because now the very definition of property is subject to a whole raft of factors that really have had heretofore no relationship to whether or not there was an interest in property. But now interests in property are going to be much more subjective than they have in the past. So I'm disappointed by the opinion. I certainly think that we can argue that it should be confined to its facts. I think when we actually come to litigating these cases that we will see just what will happen. But I remain optimistic that there is a future for regulatory takings. It just has become more expensive and more difficult to pursue that future. Thank you, Dean.
Well, thank you. On behalf of myself and the Federal Society, my thanks go out to James Burling. He's the, again, Vice President of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation. An interesting presentation. Thank you so much. Also, I want to thank the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to the audience about our next scheduled teleforum conference calls, two of them tomorrow, one at noon on the cross-border shooting and one at 2 p.m. On the use of science in lawmaking. But until that next teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.